All right, here we go, boys. In 10 seconds.
Sounding good.
The Graylian is back on the KGRA airwaves. Light waves. All right, in 4, 3, 2, 1, we're live.
Time to rock and roll. Oh, I'm sorry, Geronimo!
This is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, welcome one and all, I'm Micah Hanks. And that means, of course, this is the Graylian Report. Time to lock in, lock down, and look ahead at the week in the fringe. Glad, as always, to be here, your cosmic host. In fact, we'll be getting a little cosmic later in the program. More on that in a moment. First, allow me to introduce the co-host with the ghostly eyes, Mr. Matthew Oakley, sitting across from me here across the Graylian Master Console. Good evening to you, pal.
Eve to you as well.
Eve, indeed. All you members of the world's most secret society out there, and also regular average listeners, all are welcome at the table right here. So, a lot going on this week, as always. New claims that an old mystery has been solved, and in fact, one which names a suspect. That's right. We're also going to be looking a little bit at spontaneous human combustion, which there was a story recently, right around the turn of the seasons. But another story from the same part of the world has now emerged twice. Could it be more than coincidence? Actually, it could still be coincidence. And then, of course, the connections that can be made in our weird universe. In fact, I think that some would say that weirdness itself is kind of weird. At least one blogger did. We're going to hear what he has to say about that and how Wi-Fi-like features of the human mind could even connect people on a level that maybe is not beyond sensory, but perhaps beckons to an aspect of sensory awareness that most are not aware of. Now, I tell you, it's so good to be here with Matt, talking with all you guys, getting back into the gear of a live Graylian show, but only one thing truly makes a Graylian show. Without him, it's all for naught, almost. And that, of course, is the presence of my space-time companion across the airwaves, back in Master Control, Mr. Race Hobbo Hobbs in Arkansas. How you doing, brother? And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It's great to be back.
Better than great. In fact, Race, I got an opportunity to catch up and talk with Race this morning. And as much as Matt and I enjoy doing this show, going on into our eighth year here, Race, you are as integral a part of this as anybody. And it never feels quite like home without you here. And over the holidays, everybody's schedule, we've been so busy, we haven't been able to link up regularly, whether for the show or just to catch up and talk. We remedied that today and back on the airwaves. I couldn't feel better. Notice, Matt, I have a totally different energy about me when Race is here.
I know. And the thing is I didn't get to have that conversation earlier. So this is like a belated Christmas gift, just getting to hear the Hobbs.
Oh, Reverend, you are too sugar sweet. Well, I got to be honest with you. I've got to say hello to all the Graylian listeners. I miss all of you, and I've missed being here. And but I'm all better. All the work is caught up. I got over my illness there for a couple of weeks. I was down off. I was out of the game. But, you know, it is all too refreshing to hear the both of you again, to be back in the chair. What a blessing it is. I'm good to go. I'm ready to go, gentlemen.
That's right. I'm seeing people also filtering into the chat room there. So good to see all you guys in the chat room. If you aren't there or you'd like to be, but you're listening live elsewhere, just head over to kgraradio.com, our home on the darkest corner of the web. Add to that URL /chat, C-H-A-T. You can join us right there live Monday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time. Glad to have you in pocket. All you guys. So, Race, one thing you and I, even today, it was more like a business catch-up earlier, so we hadn't had time to really talk about this, and there's definitely something on my mind, on a lot of people's minds. Some out there are probably tired of hearing about it, but yeah, it has to do with all the UFO talk right now, and I think, again, The straw that broke the proverbial camel's back did involve a report co-authored by Leslie Kane, which appeared in the New York Times back before Christmas. And everybody's been talking about this, but I know that UFOs are kind of a sweet spot for you, and you and I have not talked about this. So I'm eager, at very least, right here at the outset, to get a little of that conversation going. I just want your perspectives. You've no doubt been watching all this from home over the holidays. Any thoughts, insights, or opinions?
Well, I have, from the moment that the story broke all the way to this very moment we're talking about it, still stand on my first impression, and that was that regardless of where this goes, it still has everybody talking about it. I received emails and phone calls from relatives and friends that know I'm involved in UFOs and have an interest in it, but we never talk about it. We never converse about it. We never bring it up, you know, when we're bowling or golfing or whatever. You know, it's just never something we really talk about. Well, I was inundated with contacts from all my friends and family that, you know, saw this come out in the New York Times and the Washington Post and mainstream media, NBC News, ABC, CBS. They all jumped in on this. And with that said, with the fact that it has sparked conversation and interest in those out there who don't follow UFOs or the subject of ufology, I think that's a good thing. On the other hand, I would just say this. I think it's very important for those of us that do follow UFOs and UAPs and the subject of unidentified aerial phenomena in the skies above us worldwide, should be steadfast. Be very careful. Don't rush to judgment. Don't get in too big of a hurry to take a stance on the validity of this until you know, you really get, you know, some hardened facts. I've heard a lot of people, a lot of speculation. There's a lot of people throwing a lot of stuff around, and 90% of it that I've come across is just rehashed jargon from somewhere, some place they found on the web, on the, you know, Facebook or Twitter or some website. It's very important for those of us that do this work to be very careful and just do the real scientific research. Anytime anything like this happens, and it doesn't happen very often, but anytime it happens, it is sanctioned by the government authorities somewhere.
You mean a release like this?
You know, the paper trail with some of these folks and the stories that they've told have been vetted and found to be true and all of that. And that's good. But you don't leave the government and start hauling off videos and paperwork and documents and just you're free to go throw those around anywhere you want. It's just not the case. I think Harry Reid, it was very cool that he, you know, got involved in this and did what he did. I think that I'm just curious to see where this goes. Tom DeLonge and the whole bit with Tom, you know, he has taken a beating, and on some levels, I think he deserves it, and some that he doesn't. But with that said, he's still doing something. You know, it's just, it's up to us to make sure, it's up to those of us that are in this day in and day out to make sure that that what's going on is the truth, and that, you know, we make sure that what we say and what we stand on can be vetted and verified, because there's a lot of conversation going around that can't. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, in regards to the video, it's very compelling. Both of them, it's very compelling video. But it, you know, for us, it's really nothing new. You know, J. Allen Hynek said, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, that maybe more than that, that, well, it was probably back in the 70s, that it was back in the 70s, that, you know, he was not privy to gun cam footage and military pilot investigations that came into Blue Book. Mm-hmm. And that was a part of the catalyst that, you know, that turned his opinion from a disbeliever to a believer. That was a part of it. That was a part of what caused him initially to start to develop doubt in the project that he had been involved in and an employment with the government.
Well, one thing he'd said, Race, you know, Dr. Hynek had always said, let's just be clear from the outset about one thing. Blue Book was not a scientific project. It was not a scientific organization or a committee that was scientifically examining these things. They were just collecting data. If anybody was the scientist who was called in to look at the UFO reports, it was J. Allen Hynek. And what's interesting about that is, as we've talked about on the program, Rob O'Connell, okay, coming on the program and talking about that, that was a great discussion. Having written the biography on J. Allen Hynek, he came into that whole thing very much a UFO skeptic. Now, I'll bet you that guys like Luis Elizondo probably did too, but then they are made privy to things that, as a civilian scientist, J. Allen Hynek and others weren't, which was, of course, the military data upon which, again, any, I think, scientist, if they had access to that information and maybe the best UFO footage, information, data, et cetera, that is available, and obviously not on a civilian level. Again, I stand by that statement in the sense that Elizondo himself, with all the media attention this has gotten recently, has been asked, so you released two videos, you're telling us that there's more of that. Yeah, there's more. How much? A lot. We've got a lot more data. Again, and no doubt the Pentagon did have their own scientists that were looking into this, because that's what Elizondo has said about it. But the problem is that when we go with the media and they go to, and we're going to hear a little later in the program, we've got some sound bites from two prominent scientists. One, of course, an astrophysicist. I'll just go ahead and tell you who. I mean, it's Neil deGrasse Tyson. We've heard from him already before in the past. And one reason that I often will exercise fair use in playing sound bites relevant to the conversation in portions of this discussion, when we've been talking about UFOs recently on the show, when it's Neil deGrasse Tyson, or as we're also going to hear from Michio Kaku talking about the same subject, the reason why I do that is because, in part, the response from the UFO community and people who do programs like this one, which talk about that subject occasionally, they get UFO experts on to comment. What do the UFO experts say? No surprise, kind of like what you just said, Race. We've known about this kind of thing for a long time, but again, I know that Matt and I and you, like you also said, Race, you put it so eloquently, a lot of us are having to try and remind ourselves to reserve judgment and don't leap to conclusions. What has the Pentagon released? Well, it's some interesting data, courtesy of, well, it wasn't a Pentagon release so much as it was Luis Elizondo coming forward and talking about it. But then there was, thanks to journalistic endeavors, there was acknowledgement of the existence of this organization, thanks to the New York Times and other media agencies, made by the Pentagon, and also by guys like Harry Reid, who said, yeah, I support what we did too. Now, the whole point is, we know that there was a program. We know that they, according to Elizondo, were trying to scientifically study whatever this technology was. They were trying to assess any threats, find out what the source was behind it. And then, of course, they were collecting data, which presumably would be useful in the further determining of whatever this phenomena ultimately represents and who or what is responsible for it, behind it, etc. So all of these things taken into consideration, there's a lot that we presumably could have to work with in terms of data, but that's not available on the civilian level. And so certain UFO researchers who have long said that there is a UFO investigative group, or that there maybe have been several of them over the years, who knows how many similar programs there have been over the years, and whether to the tune of a mere $22 million or maybe more, maybe less, there probably have been ongoing studies. Stanton Friedman and others have continued to say this over the years, and so I'm not surprised by that. The question is, at what point will, A, this information be made available on a civilian level so that civilian scientists who are called in on the television programs to comment, and then they kind of have these lackluster responses like Neil deGrasse Tyson, hey, great, they were studying this, but, you know, as an astrophysicist, I don't look at that and say aliens, I agree, and I don't know what it is, and therefore, I mean, it just kind of, it is what it is. I mean, he has this kind of whatever attitude about it.
Right.
I get that. I actually can sympathize with that, especially since Neil deGrasse Tyson, everybody in the world's asking him what he thinks about UFOs, and nobody's given him any good data to work with so that he can form a better opinion. So again, those are the questions. At what point will people on the civilian level, scientists, whatever else, independent academic scholars, at what point will people on the civilian level be made privy to that information so that they can assess this for themselves? Or will we be? We've been asking that question for a long time. Maybe it's...
Mike, and honestly, it makes you wonder why they don't bring in a Michio Kaku or a Neil deGrasse Tyson. Why didn't they call them up when they were doing this work as, you know, associate scientists to look into this along the way?
Or have they?
He's right. He cannot go on the record and say one way or the other when he doesn't know. This very well could be, you know, I was talking with some of our colleagues about this a few nights ago. You know, I just threw it in, threw the hat in the ring that this very well could be, and Grant Cameron was one of these, and he agreed, this very well could be the government attempt to roll out our own technology to our adversaries. This could be a plan that every gun cam footage we see of every object we see could be the objects could be our own technology now. And most likely, and I'll go on the record and say this, and most likely back generated technology from extraterrestrial craft or craft beyond this earth. And what a clever way to let our adversaries know. You know, you remember back when they rolled out the stealth bomber in Palmdale out there on that tarmac and showed the world that we had this bomber that could fly anywhere on the planet undetected, deliver its nuclear payload, and then return undetected, safe and sound. It just sent shivers across the world to anybody who had ill will toward us, I guarantee you. But like a good poker player, you don't lay all your cards out on the table unless you've got an ace in the hole. Imagine what the government had, you know, behind the scenes, even back then. And then, you know, couple that with testimony from Ben Rich and several others that are and have been in that position to know what technology we're working with, working on, and have developed. What a clever way to let our adversaries know what we have in our possession. It's a really sticky situation right now. We really don't know what it is we're looking at, but we do know that the government has been looking into this publicly. Now they've admitted it, like Philip Corso talked about how they outsource this stuff to the public. This is exactly what we see in this information that's been released, and Bigelow is right at the heart of it. And there's so many other revelations that came out. I heard him talking the other day about, you know, MUFON was infiltrated by the government, you know, by proxy. But, you know, because this investigation was going on and study was going on within the government. And then some of this $22 million funding goes to Bigelow, and Bigelow goes and pays MUFON under contract to get all of their information, all of their data, all of their files, and even investigate their cases. See, before MUFON investigators could investigate them themselves.
Right.
I'd be interested to see the Bigelow contract in and of itself. See what it consists of, what kind of...
I'm going to look and see. I've got a copy of it somewhere.
Oh, okay.
I think it's on another hard drive I've got. But I actually did get a copy of that contract with MUFON from back in 07, 08, I think. He got out of the contract with MUFON early because MUFON, in the fine print in there, was not supposed to be putting money in the bank. And, you know, when I think Bigelow had all he needed and got all he thought they had and investigated some of the biggest and best cases that came in within the course of that intro, of that time, he simply opened up the books and found out MUFON had money in the bank. And that's the technicality he got out of and got out of, the MUFON contract. I mean, it was a lot of money they were paying MUFON every month. And, the less and less and less and less and less he was getting, the less those checks, the less amount they were getting. They kept reducing the amount of money they were sending them. So, I mean, there's a lot of devil in a lot of those details. But, I mean, you know, this has stretched far outside of just a video of an unknown object by Navy pilots.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, I don't know if I should mention his name, a secret government insider, a friend of mine. He's texting me right now. Not really a secret government insider, but definitely somebody with a background as it relates to the military. And he simply notes, it is absolutely right what Ray says about this possibly being a way to release U.S. technology to our adversaries. Now, playing devil's advocate, again, wouldn't it make more sense, though, to do so through official channels so there's no ambiguity about what technology is being released rather than showing what appear to be our existing known technologies, tracking this technology and being incapable of identifying it? I mean, it's not to say that there isn't already secrecy between different branches of government already as it is, and that sometimes communication channels aren't open based on things like need to know. I get that. But it is concerning to me that we've got apparent technologies in our skies, as evidenced by Pentagon study groups and footage revealed that details this. And we've got fighter pilots in aircraft, okay, some of the most advanced airborne equipment that we have at our disposal. They're tracking, they're observing, they're filming, and they can't identify the other objects that they're seeing. I'm not saying it couldn't be our own. That certainly is at least a possibility, if not a likely one, but one of many. The problem I see with that question is, Again, if that's the way that this information is being disseminated to the public and we're trying to send a message to potential enemies of the United States by doing so, why does it appear to be the case that people within our own government aren't capable of identifying these craft too? What purpose could they serve if, again, our military, our U.S. Air Force, you know, other agencies and the Pentagon themselves, they themselves, at least on these levels of knowledge, the investigative groups, et cetera, they themselves don't know what in the world we're studying. Doesn't it seem a little weird that we would appropriate funding for studying something that belongs to our own government?
Yeah, I mean, it would be counterintuitive, even if it is some sort of misdirection scheme. You know, it would be far more intelligent to actually just deny all existence.
Or to say that, again, this is absolutely our technology, and it's time we go ahead and make it.
Nothing here, nothing to see here. Listen, it's very much within the realm of possibility when you're talking about the government, compartmentalization, deep black projects, trillions of dollars that go unaccounted for every year. they come out with this public budget of, you know, several billion dollars. Come on, we know better. The fact of the matter is, and then, you know, and that's another interesting point, Micah, you were talking about you know, these pilots and that sort of thing. That's another thing that I gleaned from this video. Pilots talk.
And no, certainly they can speak, and they even speak English, but go ahead.
They talk to each other. They communicate with each other. You know, he expressed ridicule from some of the other pilots, and they were laughing and joking about him when he got back on the flight deck. And even months and months and months and months later, when he was deployed to the Middle East, there were pilots that had heard about his story and asked him about what he saw. So we know now that they do talk. They do converse. This very well could be a catalyst that starts to open the gates to allow more pilots to open up and come forward with what they saw.
Let's hope. And again, the dialogue, if nothing else, has begun. That's the important part. Indeed, it's very good to hear Hobbs back in the saddle again. And of course, all the Graylian gang here in studio. We'll get to a little news when we come back. And then later, we've got some audio sound bites from the scientific community about this subject. It is the Graylian Report. Company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. I'm Micah Hanks, and it is the Graylian Report. The conversation never stops, and if you want to keep it going, you can not only join us there in the chat room, but also tweet at us at Graylian Report, at Micah Hanks, and at Reverend Oakley, or Graylian Reverend.
Graylian Reverend, yeah.
I can't keep up with all your monikers. Now, getting back into this conversation, I want to get to some news here in a second, but what Matt and I were talking about here is the fact that for a long time, this was during the break, so it was off the air. I mean, I've maintained an interest in Bob Bigelow, and I'd wanted to know years ago why he was funding MUFON and what was happening with the information that was coming back to MUFON, because your question to me, Matt, was, and as this is kind of referring to some things that were being discussed there in the chat room, people were asking and discussing the purchase of information from MUFON. And Matt says, you know, was that really ethical that that they were selling their UFO data and stuff like that? But if, as I understand it, what we're talking about when we use that terminology, selling UFO data and things like that, and I'm not a member of MUFON, I've never been. I was invited, however, by their national communications director, Roger Marsh. He asked me at one time to join, and part of the reason for that was because the program that MUFON has been involved with over the years through History Channel, I believe, called Hangar One. At one time, they were looking for a new host for that program, or someone, again, they were kind of tossing around ideas, and one of the ideas had been that they might have a host that kind of did narration and things like that on that show. And Roger thought, well, you know, again, Micah, you know, you do podcasting, and you've kind of got a voice for that kind of thing. I think you'd be great for this, and I'd like to float your name to the producers. But the problem was I was not a member of MUFON. And he said, if you're interested in doing something like this, would you be interested in coming on board on MUFON? And what I'd told him was, you know, I'd love to do that, but what I'd love to do is kind of work with MUFON rather than being a member or an investigator or something like that. I wish I could work in some sort of an advisory way with MUFON, because I was interested in trying to get a hardline kind of, and even skeptically driven, scientific perspective involved in the process of investigation that the Mutual UFO Network does. And that's whether it was coming from me. Again, I'm not somebody who, by virtue of lab experience or credentials or degrees or whatever else, I'm not a qualified active scientist. I am a person who I believe is a science writer and an advocate of science in all things. Some people, by virtue of the fact that I talk about things like UFOs, would have and long have argued that there's nothing scientific about you, Micah Hanks. But again, the point is if government has shown interest in UFOs, and yes, that we've got investigative groups that do try to study what apparently is this phenomena, if nothing else has changed between 2017 and 2018, at very least as it relates to that subject, what we now have is some serious discussion of it. And yes, if science can't be applied to a subject that involves a potential mysterious technology in our midst, I don't know what else you could possibly better select in terms of things that science should be applied to. If we're going to study it, science must be applied to it. And that's not to say that it hasn't been. But, you know, when I was talking with Roger Marsh about MUFON briefly at one point, that was what the nature of our conversation really was. I was very adamant about saying, what can I do that helps bring science to this? So anyway, full disclaimer, you know, I'm not a member and I haven't ever been, but I've got a lot of friends in MUFON. Okay. And I'd long been interested in, and I'd asked Roger Marsh at that time, we were on the telephone. Roger's been a friend for years and he's been a guest on this show in the past. And I said, if perhaps we're going to open dialogue about this, maybe you can answer some questions for me. And one of the things I asked him, I said, you know, what's the deal with Robert Bigelow? What involvement has he had with MUFON? Roger was completely forthcoming. He says, yeah, I can answer that question for you. I know it's been kind of controversial. People have wanted to know what Bigelow was doing, why he was funding MUFON, what happened with that. And so Roger, being the dear soul that he is, I mean, he explained all that to me. Also, my friend Chase Kletsky and I have had a lot of conversations about that. Caleb and I went down a few years ago, stayed with her at her home in Georgia. And we had, I mean, that was kind of the focal point of the entire weekend, was talking about Bigelow and MUFON. Well, lo and behold, a few years later, we come to find that Bob Bigelow was getting information, or not information so much as funding, from Harry Reid and the Pentagon in relation to UFO studies. So, you know, I guess I can at very least say I'm vindicated in the interest I've had in him over the years. And I'll leave it at that for the time being. This whole thing to me is extremely interesting. The most unusual aspect to it is not so much that there appears to be this technology or this phenomena or whatever. The most unusual thing about the whole UFO phenomenon right now to me is that there are still people who say that there's nothing to see here. All weather balloons. Silliness. It's just crazy.
Swamp gas, man. Swamp gas.
Silliness, swamp gas, stuff like that. Look, I promise in the next hour, at very least, we're going to change gears and not talk about UFOs. But I do have a couple of sound bites that I want to feature here that have to do with this subject. And I guess it's timely. It's on everybody's mind. Might as well go ahead and talk about it right now. Okay, so the first of these sound bites, we've featured sound bites that have to do with Neil deGrasse Tyson being asked about UFOs. Assistant Lauren brought this one to my attention, and I have to say this one is quite good. She said, I enjoyed this. You should really play this on the show. And indeed, it is good. This was an appearance that Neil deGrasse Tyson made on Colbert's show. And Colbert's sitting there talking with him and playing, again, a comedic kind of devil's advocate against Neil deGrasse Tyson, but asking some very good questions and raising some very good points. We have audio.
So recently, into our solar system, above the, what's it called, the plane of the ecliptic?
Sure.
Okay, where the planets go around?
Yeah.
From above or below or whatever, yeah. Off the axis of where the planets go around.
If the planets all do this around the sun.
This thing came from deep space, not in our system, not from your Oort cloud or your Kuiper
first
belt.
Time.
Now, they are referring to, of course, the Oumuamua, this large, elongated, what's believed to be an asteroid. But as Neil deGrasse Tyson describes it, it may not be a single solid object. Very interesting. And he explains why he thinks that.
Ever an object from interstellar space has been observed to visit our solar system.
Now, this thing's got to be like a ship, right? That looks too much like a spaceship.
This is not a photograph.
What?
This is an artist's rendering. We know it's elongated. I don't believe this is...
Just... You don't get to take. What about that? What about that one right there? You hold it, whatever you want.
You got people.
You got people. I got people. Look at that. So, okay, but it looked like that.
No. So
what do you say? It was elongated.
I'm just saying. Cigars don't come journeying into solar system.
Or do they? By the way, it's an extremely funny segment. You can go on YouTube and you can see this. It's very fun. And in large part, that's kind of what Neil deGrasse Tyson does. He is kind of like the funny man of science. Every time I hear the guy talk, I mean, he's very knowledgeable, but he is more a comedian than he is a scientist. I saw him speak, gave a 2-hour lecture here in Asheville. I mean, it's foul-mouthed and funny, but 2 hours of that, and it's not bad. I mean, I enjoy it. It's just, again, he is as much a comedian as he is a promoter of science. So keep that in mind as you're listening.
So, which is why it has to be an alien
this
spaceship.
This is a Cohiba cigar.
Yeah. Right.
So.
Yeah.
Asteroids, we know.
Yeah.
Many of them, if not most of them, are loosely held together rubble piles.
Uh-huh.
And if they come near gravitational sources, tidal forces can stretch them so that they become a stream of particles rather than just one solid mass.
So this thing isn't solid?
It is likely not solid.
What is it?
But the signal we get from it is elongated, but it's probably a rubble pile stretched into that shape.
Because
you don't get that by nature. You don't get that.
Yeah, that's why it's man-made.
Alien-made. You want that to be aliens. Just fess up. You want that to be aliens.
Of course I want that to be aliens.
Okay, so...
That's the whole point of this question that I've never finished.
Here's the problem. This thing came in moving fast.
Yeah.
It has escape velocity, a hyperbolic orbit.
What?
Okay, hyperbolic trajectory.
Okay.
That's why we say hyperbolic. Yeah. Hyper is,
yeah.
It's got more energy
than a bolic.
Than a bolic, yeah, hyperbolic. But it's parabolic, for example.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so the reason why it's probably not aliens is its trajectory around the sun was completely determined by gravitational forces.
How do you know?
Now, this is the interesting part. Listen right here. This is where Colbert makes a very good point. Talking with Tyson about this and how gravity could play a role in the trajectory of an interstellar object, whether or not of alien. Well, I mean, you can't say it's not of alien origin if it's interstellar, but the point is this intelligently controlled and designed by intelligent alien life? That's the question. Okay.
Because we calculate this. We have this laws of gravity, physics.
Look at this. See this? See that? That trajectory was completely controlled by gravitational forces.
Now, what he did was he took a pin and he threw it up in the air and it came back down. And the point Colbert is trying to make is I can take this pin, just like when I launch a pin at Matt when I get angry here in the studio, I could take that pin and gravity is eventually going to bring that pin down to the ground again if it does not collide with Matt's eyeball first. And like Colbert taking a pin and throwing it up into the air, what goes up must come down. Remember Newton's apple? And he observed the apple. There's a force that drags that apple off of the apple tree and into my noggin before it hits the ground. So Colbert uses this argument to his advantage and takes a pin and he tosses it up in the air. And with the force that is applied by him throwing it, watches the pin go up and then it comes back down and hits his desk. And now he's going to explain what just happened to Neil deGrasse Tyson and then apply that to Oumuamua if this were an alien vessel.
After it reached its peak up here and came back down, and yet a thinking creature started the process, okay? It doesn't mean if this came in, you go, oh, gravity did that. But somebody made it go to here. Checkmate. Parabolic.
I think they like him.
That, my friend, is called a taste of your own medicine.
So all I'm saying is, if it's only moving by the force of gravity, then it's not, we presume it doesn't have, like, rockets and things. If this were aliens,
yeah,
and it's some kind of advanced ship, it would be maneuvering.
First question. If this is a advanced ship from outer space, are rockets the most likely system that an advanced spacecraft from elsewhere, far away? I mean, again, presumably, there's not a planet out there that's nearby that these aliens could have come from, i.e. outside of our solar system. Okay, don't fall asleep, Matt.
I'm not falling asleep. I'm just seeing where we're going.
Steve, well, well listen, this isn't hard to follow.
You're the one who interjected me into the conversation, for
okay.
God's sake.
Well, and you're sitting there kind of doing this number again. That no, thing where no, you kind of, he no. does this thing where he kind of closes his eyes real, kind of like a frog when it swallows
that,
its food and it has to,
like?
It has to close its eyes. Have you ever seen that?
What is this?
Frogs.
This is an interesting interjection into this
frogs,
conversation.
Frogs, when they
are, I don't think anybody cares.
When they swallow, frogs kind of close their eyes. And Matt does that when he starts getting, when he feels that things I'm saying are credulous is usually
no,
when I see
no,
that.
No, 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 no.
Okay.
I don't.
All right.
I was waiting.
Back off. I'm back off, man. I'm not a scientist, okay? But now, so here's the point. So now I've lost my train of thought. A pen is about to go launched across the room. I hate when Matt starts being a frog. Now, again, the idea is if this thing comes from interstellar space, are rockets and is rocket propulsion the most likely source of carrying an interstellar spacecraft from one point to another? Now, it could, hypothetically, but again, what do we use rockets for? Think about this. When we actually launch things into space, we use rockets to get them out of Earth's atmosphere, and then typically gravity carries them around the moon or around the Earth in an orbit. And what Colbert fundamentally is arguing here is that this object enters our atmosphere from an unusual angle, and then it enters the orbit. Well, first it goes in orbit around the sun, and then it takes off on a trajectory toward Jupiter. It actually behaves an awful lot like the kind of spacecraft that we send into space. Neil deGrasse Tyson is saying, well, there's no evidence of rockets or anything like that, but why in the world would there be rockets used if it's an advanced spacecraft from someplace else and presumably far more advanced than we are? Because, hey, last time I checked, we aren't sending manned probes of any kind, or at very least anything as large as Oumuamua seems to be. We aren't sending those to other galaxies, you know? He did it again. Matt, I think I need to test you, sir. Are your eyes hurting you?
No, I'm fine.
Are you okay, buddy? We're going to get an eye exam from Matt. We got a little more audio.
Doing interesting things.
But maybe it already maneuvered on its way in. It was doing a close pass around the sun to get a whip and acceleration the way they use satellites to go around the back of a planet to whip them out into outer space. You know how we use
It's called slingshot effect. Yeah,
You don't have to tell me.
That's right. So, okay, maybe the aliens shut off their engines to masquerade as a cosmic object to get a slingshot effect around our star.
Maybe we can't perceive what their engines are and that they have a
it
mode.
It could be, I can just tell you they're off. Whatever they are,
no, but did,
they're off. Because a tennis ball would have that trajectory moving at that speed. That's all.
Is there any chance that's a tennis ball?
No. No, and by the way, big news was that the Pentagon was tracking UFOs.
Here it comes. More UFO talk from Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hey, Matt, we're in this far. Let's just one more second. Here we go.
We saw the footage. They released the footage from, like, F-18 fighter pilots on their little scope there where they saw it. It's like a tablet-shaped thing.
Infrared thing.
Accelerating, stopping, accelerating, changing directions in ways that they can't explain.
That has a way better chance of being aliens than this thing.
Okay, so there you go. And that's essentially where he leaves it. This, whatever the Pentagon is studying, has a way better chance of being aliens than the Oumuamua thing. Hey, actually, I agree. I don't think that there's been any evidence shown thus far. And this is probably what Matt's qualm was, ladies and gents at home. You probably thought I was trying to say, therefore, aliens.
But no, Matt, no, no.
But here's the question. How often do I ever say, therefore, aliens?
You never do. And that's why I wasn't under the assumption you were going to.
Okay. Maybe I was just misled. Those lion eyes.
Yeah, apparently.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm with you on this.
See, he has nothing left to say. There's my mic drop.
I love the fact that we do have to entertain all of this, though, and just sit here. And here's a man who is in the know, whether you like him or don't like him and think he's a comedian.
Tyson?
Yeah.
I like Tyson.
Yeah, I'm saying whether you think he's more of a comedian than a scientist, I will absolutely concede that. But he's in the know. And we still have to entertain, like, come on, man, it could be this. No, we're asking a scientist, and he's saying, no, you know, a tennis ball with this kind of speed would have the same trajectory. Case closed.
He's talking in terms of physics, but he's also talking in terms of known physics.
Okay.
And that's the point. And I'm sure that, you know, those out there who are, of course, physicists might be rolling their eyes like Matt is. And they would be saying, oh, come on, really? So here's the point. No, here's the point. I want to say, let's see what a physicist thinks about UFOs. and about potentials for there being dynamic capabilities of these craft that go beyond what is known about physics. Because, again, I'm all for the scientific understanding that is, you know, accumulated over time thanks to guys like Isaac Newton and after him, Albert Einstein. Let's go with what the science says. But the problem is there are some people who, despite the fact that we're observing things in videos that, again, according to the Pentagon, behave in ways that are very least special or maybe even a little atypical. Let's go ahead and say unusual in relation to the laws of physics. The thing is that there are others who are saying, and there's still nothing to see here. That's a weather balloon. Last time I checked, a weather balloon did not defy the laws of physics. So, eminent physicist Michio Kaku was, this is actually a couple of years later, or older now, but he had reviewed Leslie Keene's book on UFOs that came out a few years ago. UFOs, generals, pilots, and government officials go on the record. And he appeared on a few television shows talking about this, but Michio Kaku, again, providing the perspective of physics in terms of what it could mean, what do these craft appear to be? Is there anything more to see here than nothing at all? It is quite interesting what Kaku had to say. Now, let's just keep in mind, he's a fairly open-minded physicist, too. But nonetheless, to hear him talking about UFOs and saying what you're about to hear was, I would dare say, startling.
Michio Kaku, professor of physics at CUNY University and host of Sci-Fi Science on the Science Channel, got to read the book early, and he joins us with a review. Quite simply, Professor, do unidentified flying objects without question exist?
95% of all UFO sightings can be immediately identified as the planet Venus, weather balloons, weather anomalies, swamp gas, you name it, we've got it nailed. It's the 5% that give you the willies. 5% remain totally unexplained.
And you're saying to 5% unexplained to the point where they are legitimately an unidentified flying object.
And we're talking about generals. We're talking about Air Force pilots. We're talking about governors of states that claim that, hey, this is beyond our understanding of the laws of physics.
Can I have an unidentified flying object that is not necessarily from some other place?
It's possible, but we've looked at all the alternatives. These are multiple sightings by multiple modes. In other words, pilots, eyewitnesses, radar, visual sightings. These are very hard to dismiss, the handful of sightings. One over Alaska, another over Belgium, another over Iran. The handful of things that still cannot be explained defy known laws of physics.
So then, by that definition, does this confirm the existence of life on other planets, in your opinion?
Before we actually go into that part, so what we've heard thus far, Michio Kaku says that 95% can be explained by rather prosaic things. And furthermore, that 5%, while interesting, you know, these aren't as easily explained, and there's some credible reports. So then, of course, I love how it always comes back to this on the mainstream programs. So can we prove without question that extraterrestrial life? Now, again, that's where the leap in logic becomes apparent. Michio Kaku, and I think we've got just enough time in this segment before we go to break, he responds to that question, but that's the issue. I don't understand. I guess people, it's so ingrained in the public consciousness, even if people don't believe in UFOs, that if we're going to talk about this, therefore aliens. And while that could even be a likelihood, that is not something that there is enough data for which there is a clear argument that can be made. So Michio Kaku has acknowledged some of these cases are a little harder to just you know, count out. You know, nothing to see here. Let's move along. I appreciate that. Let's see what he has to say in response to this guy asking, so are they aliens? I love it. Always comes back to that. Michio Kaku, what do you think?
I wouldn't go that far. We need alien DNA or an alien chip. That would nail it to the wall right there. We don't have that. We don't have the smoking gun. But this book is as close as you're going to get to the smoking gun. We're talking about senior military officials who were involved in the investigations of these incidents saying we are clueless.
If you were to look at those who argue, well, hang on, there's no way that they could get here from some other planet, that the technology doesn't exist, the stars are too far away, you rebut that sort of thinking with what?
Those people assume that there may be 100 years ahead of us, in which case it's impossible for them to reach us. But if they're 1,000, 1,000,000 years ahead of us, then new laws of physics begin to open up. So we have...
Hold on. Michio Kaku just said, if they are 1,000,000 years ahead of us, new laws of physics begin to open up. Matt's getting angrier and angrier.
No.
I'm going to get in trouble is what's going to happen.
Do new laws open up? I know what he said, so you don't have to.
Do I need to reiterate it?
No, you don't have to do that. But can we? Is that what he meant? Do new laws?
I think that's probably what he meant. I mean, he said it.
Do new laws open up, or do new abilities to manipulate the laws, or whatever?
Well, I don't know.
Present themselves.
He said,
because that's a very big distinction we can make.
Yeah, but then again, I mean, when he says new laws, what if there are existing laws of the universe out there, but they are undiscovered, and we, through science, learn about them? We would, by definition, call those new laws, even though they've been here since time immemorial. I think that's what he's trying to say, is that new laws, at least according to human understanding,
to open our mind to the possibility that they're not just a super version of us, that they could be thousands, millions of years more advanced.
Why would they not then pay us a visit in a way that is more recognizable? Go visit the White House, maybe stop out to Yellowstone.
My point of view is...
Can we ask some more dumb questions, by the way?
If you're walking on a country road in St. Anthill, you go down to the ants and say, I bring you trinkets, I bring you beads, I give you nuclear energy, or perhaps maybe you step on a few of them. If they're that advanced, maybe they simply are not that interested in us.
Gah. Some of those questions. So again, I think that the point that Michio Kaku is trying to make there is we, in our all-knowing, okay, we humans, we often think that we know everything. I remember John B. Alexander talking about going to a science symposium where a physicist got up and said, we pretty much unlocked 99.9% of all phenomena that occurs in the universe. And basically that 0.01% that we were left with, that's basically us just tying together loose ends, but we pretty much figured everything out. It very well could be that of all the range of things that could exist in the universe, maybe there are some things, this is a bit of a stretch for folks, but there could be some things that humans haven't yet discovered. There could be new laws of physics, at least by human description, even if they've existed forever and ever. And who knows, if there are intelligent beings out there, whether or not we can prove that they're here right now, maybe they have a better grasp on these things than we do. We'll return here in a moment. It is the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Oh boy, keeping it company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time. Worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. I'm Micah Hanks. Glad to be back in the pocket here. I mean, this isn't our first show of 2018, but honestly, tonight, we're kind of jiving. It's feeling like we're kind of getting back into the swing of things. That's okay. You know, you got to take a little downtime around the holidays. I hope you guys did. I actually hardly took any time off over the holidays. But nonetheless, I'm still getting back into the swing. You know, Matt, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Getting back into the swing of the thing that we do every week. If you like what we do and you'd like more of it, head on over to GraylianReport.com/X. Where you can sign up, you can become a subscriber, and of course you can gain access to additional content. For instance, over the weekend, Matt and I did an examination of the Chicago O'Hare International Airport incident. Okay, where I believe back in 2006 there was a UFO that was seen hovering over like gate C-18. It was a flight bound right down here for North Carolina. They see a literal flying saucer hovering above the airport. Numerous witnesses. John Hilkovich, writing for the Chicago Tribune, wrote about this. It overnight became the most viewed article on their website in the history of the Chicago Tribune. And yes, Leslie King reported on that in her book, which Michio Kaku, we heard him commenting on in the last segment. So again, you know, what little role we play here on this program and what we're trying to do, I think that there are a couple of things, twofold approach here. We are trying to offer a perspective on a podcast that talks about these kind of issues and one that features ideas from leading scientists, the likes of which Michio Kaku and Neil deGrasse Tyson and others, I realistically could not get to come on a program like this. But it's still important for me as a person who advocates what science teaches us, what leading scientists and educated professionals think. I do want to try and highlight their perspectives on these kinds of issues and not just those of, for instance, the UFO community. And then Matt here, we've been talking, we have not stopped every segment. Yeah, yeah. Every segment we're going to break, and poor guy, he's getting steamrolled here because I just won't shut up tonight.
No, but, not at all, for God's sake.
I really won't.
And you play audio clips that it's like just grazes the surface, and I feel like, all right, I guess we're going for 6 hours live tonight because
we could.
That one Michio Kaku soundbite could send us for the next 6 hours, I think. There are far deeper philosophical questions.
Let's actually get into some of that real quick because we've got a lot to cover, and I do want to finally get away from the UFO subject in this hour. But I want to give you your due and your proper, let you have your say. You're a co-host of the program, and so as Matt was telling me during the break, there are philosophical questions that should be asked, and I agree, and that, here's the whole thing. As much as I appreciate perspectives from physicists and leading, you know, astrophysicists, astronomers, whatever else, I am concerned with this attitude among academicians today, and we've talked about this in the past, people like Stephen Hawking who have said that philosophy is dead, but we can learn a lot from philosophy. And further degrading is the attitude taken by those physicists who have said things like this, who say of those philosophers of science, or philosophers of history, people who apply philosophy to, and they ask questions, epistemologically or otherwise, about these areas of study and focus. I remember a physicist, I'm trying to remember which one it was, may have been Hawking actually, saying that, yeah, I think he said it in A Brief History of Time, that philosophers of science are usually failed physicists who think that they are inept enough to actually contribute anything to science, and so they become philosophers of science. And the hubris that is ingrained in a statement like that, to me, the philosophers and the philosophers of science are the ones that help balance the observations of the scientists. So Matt, again, says we could spend 6 hours talking about what Michio Kaku said there, and let's get into a little bit. I'm afraid I can only give you 6 minutes.
Okay.
But let's talk about the philosophy of it. Go.
Well, and I think about one of the things that I was thinking about as we were listening to that was a Douglas Adams quote, famous for Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Wrote Doctor Who episodes too.
Yes, that's right. And he said, in an infinite universe, anything is possible. Okay.
Wait a minute. I said that.
You said that?
I said that, but he said that too.
Everybody's said that, I'm sure, at some point.
Wait, so, you mean some people in different parts of the world and in different periods in time can even have the same idea?
Yeah, it's
weird.
This
is crazy.
It's almost like we're on a loop.
Yeah.
Here as a species.
Weird.
And so that leads me around to what we were discussing. Are there limitations of the human body? Are there limitations of the human mind? If we do unlock secrets of the universe, secrets of physics that we don't yet know, are they even applicable to us as a species? Who's to say another alien race doesn't exist on some other wavelength than we do, and so therefore they are able to unlock something where we are not?
Did you look at like our show notes page? Because pretty much everything you just said right there is everything we're about to start talking about.
I know.
Okay, good. I was about to say.
I added some of those stories too. I know. So, yeah. But these are the things I think we just kind of gloss over because they are unanswerable questions for the most part, I think.
Well, for now.
Yeah, at least for now. But the thing is to just sit here and say, yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, this is the question we have to ask ourselves. Are we constrained by our physiology and our intellectual capacity in some fashion or another? And is this, dare I say, now, I do think the answer to this question is yes. Is it worth it to go down the rabbit hole on some of these issues, some of these, you know, in search of issues, if we are never able to unlock them? And of course, I think yes is the answer. Because how are we ever supposed to know if we can or cannot unlock secrets of the universe if we don't at least try?
Yeah.
So, but I think we can end up going, as you said, around, or as I said, around the record player, you know, over and over and over again, not really getting anywhere because we're focusing our intellectual capacity in the wrong direction.
Which maybe you would say the physicists have argued when they've said philosophy is dead. I remember, and I disagree, but let's at least play that fairly and examine that side of the argument. Bill Nye the Science Guy had been the one that said, you know, all this stuff about philosophers and philosopher students, it's like you're spending so much time thinking about thinking that you're not actually progressing. Science and physics and chemistry, we use science and we progress our knowledge and we move forward and we innovate and we come up with new applications for these discoveries, which move society forward. Whereas the physicists, while the philosophers, they're asking questions about all that stuff and they're not actually moving us forward. Now, I disagree. But the point that really, and maybe it could be worded more eloquently than Bill Nye did when he said that, maybe the point he was trying to make was that is asking questions day in and day out about discoveries, while meaningful, is that the best use of our time? Matt, I love archaeology. I love, 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 love archaeology. But there are times where I'll read the headlines and I read Elon Musk and I read about Stephen Hawking, you know, or all of the aforementioned people who I respect and who I don't mean to sound like we're attacking when we talk about on this program. It's not that at all. We're discussing things that they have said, and that is not tantamount to an attack. But I tell you, when I think about, for instance, digging in the dirt and studying ancient, you know, history, as important as that subject is, Matt, I have certain days of the week where I kind of go, but am I moving society and civilization forward by looking at the past? In many ways, yes. In many ways, yes. But then I also think about, but we've also got, you know, material resource scarcity. We've got the potential for dangers from everything from climate change to asteroid strike. Sure, some of these things do come into
domestic and foreign issues, to tangible human issues, you know?
And that's the issue is that, and you know, my brother Jason Pentrail's often said to me, the thing that's so important the thing that is so important to me about archaeology is that it is physical and tangible and is something that can be easily studied. UFOs, they don't present something physical, tangible, and something easily studied, so why spend time studying them? And yet, on the other hand, I kind of think, but what would happen if Elon Musk got interested in UFOs? And I'm not saying that he necessarily needs to go start studying and trying to crack this mystery. What if that interest was merely, gosh, look at this, this is incredible. Whatever that is, whoever's that is, or whoever it belongs to, whoever created it, is irrelevant. All that we needed to know was that it could be done, and I see this video, and now I know, yes, it can, therefore I will. And, I mean, when we think about the kinds of innovations that could move us forward, I'm not saying archaeology doesn't do that. It's very important, and that's why I love it. But playing devil's advocate with myself sometimes, I have to kind of stop and go, you know, we all have interests, and everybody can convince themselves that the things that interest them are important, and that the things that someone else is interested in are less important than the things that interest us. And I catch myself kind of going, are the things that I'm passionate about, are they even necessarily things that move society and civilization forward? You know, and I think that if science is being applied to it and we are gaining new knowledge, whether it's about the past, the present, or even potentials for the future, all of those things are good.
Everything is good as long as science is moving us in a direction. You say forward, but science, you know, not necessarily always moves us forward. I invoke him a lot on this program, but the infinite wisdom of the character Ian Malcolm in the Jurassic Park series, scientists, you know, get so preoccupied with whether we can, and I think that's not just scientists, we as a species, as far as the internet culture, social media, everything we do, we are so preoccupied whether we can do something, we forget sometimes to stop and ask whether or not we should. And so I think we need philosophy and we need science. We need about 50 of each. This is why the doomsday clock, you know, that's a philosophical outlet for science, I think. You know, we're gauging certain directions in the human condition and how long we have, 2 minutes to midnight. And, you know, it's one of those things where we need a hearty balance of the two. We need 50 of each to sit here and, you know, just scream at each other all day and all night.
And let's not scream. Come on.
You know what I'm saying.
The issue here.
I think you just microaggressed a little bit.
What?
Nothing. Go ahead.
I mean, no, the point I'm saying is that we need respectful, insightful, calm, and focused dialogue. But I think that it shouldn't be one-sided. And yes, I think that those of a philosophical mind, those of a scientific disposition, we all bring a little something to the table. And really, and this is going to be the final word on the UFO subject for tonight's show. But maybe those who have long advocated UFO studies and have been marginalized and treated like crazy individuals for saying so, maybe based on things we've seen in recent weeks, that viewpoint should be entertained as well. It should be subjected to the same philosophical and scientific scrutiny, but not in a way that resorts to ad hominem and just tearing people down. That should be respectfully discussed, and that should be included in the dialogue.
And I say scream in regards to make your voice be heard. Each side should be just as powerful as the other, and it should be a power struggle.
Here he comes back to screaming. It always comes back to snakes, actually. That's really what it always comes back to, really, is snakes.
Really? Does it have to?
Why did it always have to be snakes? I don't know.
I don't know.
You answer that. Anyway. Now, John Horgan over at Scientific American, I've been tough on them recently, too, because, again, I'd taken issue with what one of their authors had to say about UFOs. Nothing to see. We've known what UFOs were for decades. Weather balloons, blah, 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 blah. I think that that's a very silly attitude to have when we've got footage that shows things that we can't explain that we've got Neil deGrasse Tyson, Michio Kaku, and others commenting on. But to each their own. And I've taken some issue with things as on the archaeological front that Michael Shermer has said in his column at Scientific American too. So I don't want to feel, or I don't want to come across seeming like I'm too hard on Scientific American. And Matt, you found this brilliantly eloquent and weird philosophical blog post.
I put it on the show notes page after reading the first two paragraphs was all I was like, well, we have to discuss this article.
And I'm not going to read the entire thing. I've actually just got a couple of select quotes from it that I want to feature. But John Horgan, the post is titled The Weirdness of Weirdness. And I want to use this to set the stage for some discoveries in this next hour that we're going to touch on that really kind of come back to a lot of the things that Matt's talking about right there. And things that, again, the fundamental questions are, how do we know what we know? Are there things that may exist outside of what humans are capable of perceiving or understanding? You know, are there, as Michio Kaku said, new laws of physics? Is that a misnomer? Do we really understand all that there is to understand about physics? Or 100 years from now, will there be another Einstein that comes along and helps reshape? And Einstein's theories, though significant, and penultimately so, will they be viewed kind of like Newton's pre-existing structure, and there's a better term I'm thinking of here for that, rather than a structure, I guess a framework. You know, the Newtonian framework was the universe as we know it until Einstein came along. Einstein himself said, and I figured my contributions would be one small part. I didn't think that everybody would rewrite the physics books based on what I discovered. And someone, he said, would come along and they would do what I did, and perhaps much better, and they would explain things that my relativity didn't account for. What's incredible is that we haven't found anybody else. No one has come along yet who has done that. And incredible, though, and important, though, the insights of Sir Stephen Hawking have been, and he being, I think, one of the probably most widely known celebrity physicists today, he and Michio Kaku both, and there are a few others too. Brian Greene, you know, we can name him, but Hawking has kind of captured the public imagination, but I don't think that his discoveries or contributions can quite measure up to those of Einstein. Einstein, again, with relativity, he redefined physics as we know it. But Einstein himself, and again, that's the point, he said someone else will come along and do what I've done and do it even better. When that happens, as Kaku said, there will be probably new laws of physics that we, again, will have observed and we will understand at that point, but we aren't to that point yet. So John Horgan, writing at the blogs for Scientific American, he said, weirdness should dissipate as we explain more and more things. Okay? Being mind-boggled by all things all the time certainly doesn't seem adaptive. And in fact, psychiatrists have pathologized feelings of acute weirdness or estrangement from reality. They call this condition derealization. Now, I just got to say, while perhaps not a candidate for derealization psychologically speaking, I can really identify with what John Horgan is talking about here. Because when we have, look, when you have sat in a chair behind a microphone for 8 years and talked about these kind of subjects every single week and trying, if anything, championing having a scientific mind and putting a scientific perspective behind all these things, whether they are physical, whether it has to do with history and archaeology, whether it has to do with biology, whether it has to do with spirituality and religion, whether it has to do with any range of subjects, trying to apply logic to these things in the interest of the furtherance of humankind and our knowledge. At times, you're going to sit down, you're going to look at the body of the information in front of you and everything that you have spent years discussing and trying to wrap your head around, and you're going to say, existence is pretty weird. Okay, so I can relate to John Horgan at Scientific American. Yeah, things get pretty weird sometimes, and frankly, I end up feeling very weird taking time to try and stop and think about all this. Now, he goes on in his blog here, he says, so let me try to explain what I mean when I say that everything is weird. Since childhood, I've had moments of jaw-dropping astonishment that I or anything else even exists. Now, he also says psychedelics, which I started taking in my teens, amplified that feeling. The sensation of weirdness can have a positive or negative emotional valence. That is, it can be accompanied by ecstasy or by terror. And see, I've never ever taken psychedelics, and I still feel that way. But after these emotions fade, he says, I'm still left with the intellectual conviction that everything is really weird. Everything is really weird.
People are strange, man.
This is weird. What we're talking about, everything tonight, this is just weird, not on Graylian. He said, science, once I started learning and writing about it, corroborated this youthful intuition of weirdness. Science has revealed that the origin of the universe, of life, and of consciousness is each highly improbable. You multiply these improbabilities, and they spike toward infinity. Here's where emotions come into play. You might react to our improbability with joy because you realize how lucky we are to be alive. We shouldn't be here, and yet we are. It's a miracle! Or you might brood over how perilous our existence is because you realize that non-existence is infinitely more probable than existence. But the improbability that triggers these emotions isn't just in your head, it is out there, and so is this weirdness. The problem is many people don't think the universe, life, and consciousness are especially weird. He said, when I talk to my students about the weirdness of existence, they look baffled. They think I'm weird for insisting that existence is weird. And in fact, leading thinkers believe that science has already told us so much about the world and about ourselves that it has dissipated the mystery of things. This comes back to that note that I made last hour about John B. Alexander. Leading thinkers believe that science has already told us so much about the world. Maybe, again, according to their rationale, 99.9% of all that needs to be learned about all things, that it has dissipated the mystery of things. He says, philosopher Daniel Dennett is a prime example. He has argued for decades that life and consciousness aren't weird. They're just results of physical processes. Science hasn't pinned down all the details yet, but it's just a matter of time. Consciousness will soon seem no weirder than digestion or metabolism. If you insist that things are fundamentally weird, Dennett implies you must have some sort of flake. I'm sorry, you must be some sort of flake. Now, other philosophers disagree. In his 2013 book, Mind and Cosmos, while the materialist neo-Darwinian concept of nature is almost certainly false, Thomas Nagel argues that conventional materialistic science cannot account for the emergence of life and consciousness. Now, skipping ahead, he says, this dispute has a parallel in the realm of spirituality. I recently posted profiles of two sages with divergent ideas about the state of insight known as enlightenment. For Stephen Batchelor, a Buddhist, enlightenment consists of seeing, quote, the sheer mystery of everything, unquote. Far from getting answers to the mystery, you see, quote, the massiveness of the question, unquote, which fills you with exhilaration and dread. So he said, I don't really see the weirdness of the world anymore. He said, I'm so absorbed in my own little schemes and troubles that I usually take reality for granted, and someday scientists might convince themselves and the rest of us that the world is no longer weird because they have figured it out. They'll exult in their triumph, but when we stop seeing the world as weird, we have lost something, not gained something. Whether or not we see it, the weirdness will still be out there. Now, that was his blog there, or at least a portion of it there from the Scientific American, John Horgan, The Weirdness of Weirdness. Go read the entire article. There are a lot more points that he makes in that the lengthier article.
And if you want to find it, I just did put it up on the Facebook and Twitter pages for Graylian Report.
Excellent. Thank you, man. Yeah, so you can find it easily. But again, the point he makes, we might start by asking, well, what in the world is so weird that he's talking about? What's weird? Well, let's replace weird with another term. First of all, for illustrative purposes, let's replace weird for a moment with improbable. Life is not weird. Life is improbable. And yet here we are. Why is life improbable? Why is it improbable that life will exist here? Well, because we can look out there all throughout our universe. We see very little evidence of other life like us out there. And yet here we are. Does that mean that we're very special? Does that mean that there's something unusual going on here? Are we a fluke? Are we a hiccup? Are we an accident? Is it intelligent design? Is it grand design of some kind, or somebody else's? I mean, what is really going on here? Obviously, we can't quite put a finger on it. We don't really know. And there are plenty of other things that we don't know either. You know, this was reported by the Daily Mail. Scientists believe that they have uncovered the secret behind what are sometimes called gut feelings, claiming that the human brain has a form of what could be likened to Wi-Fi, and it's constantly gathering information on other people by simply looking at them. Now, this is according to Professor Digby Tatum of the University of Sheffield, who's been researching the human brain and how people communicate for decades. He believes his work shows that language only plays a limited role when it comes to communication. For instance, he says, if you look at professional poker players, they say they can pick up on tells from their opponents by picking up on visual clues or slight movements. I can pick up on things Matt's thinking just by when he rolls his eyes or other gestures that he makes. He says no, I say yes. Professor Tatum is a clinical professor of psychotherapy, and he has said that people can pick up on subliminal information. Maybe some of them are better at it than others. I don't know. He has written about his findings in a new book, which is called The Interbrain. Okay, and according to the Sunday Telegraph, Tatum had told them over the weekend, we can know directly about other people's emotions and what they're paying attention to. It's based on the direct connection between our brains and other people's and between their brains and ours. He says, I call this the interbrain. This goes beyond language. This goes beyond gestures. He says it's almost like a Wi-Fi that is shared between people, and we can pick up on things from them. He claims humans are drawn together at football matches, for instance, or when they go to concerts, people who attend religious ceremonies in large groups. And he feels that there is a connectedness that we share as a result of this interbrain concept. I got to get this book. He said being in a crowd may, and he calls it like a crowd mode. Okay, maybe this could be in some ways similar to the idea of collective consciousness or unconsciousness for that matter. Maybe this could be made similar or compared to a lot of other things. But in relation to this crowd mode, he says, being in crowd mode may also make us experience what it would be like to transcend out perspective or out of perspective, our time, our place, our capacity to feel for a moment like a driving being. And although he warned that communicating through video calls can interrupt this process and could cause harm, huh, that's interesting. So he feels that communicating through video calls interrupts this process. I would like to hear from people out there. info@graylianreport.com, info@micahanks.com. Do you notice any subtle differences between natural interactions that you share with people in a public space or a private space for that matter, but when you're sharing space with a person versus when you make a video call or you're communicating with that person through video over a distance? One more quote too. He says, emotional contagion occurs at the speed of light, not the speed of electronic transmission. Face-to-face visual input is accompanied by sound, by gesture, by the smell of sweat, by the possibility of touch, and by a connect. Further arguing that, again, you have to be able to share space to share this sort of interbrain connection that he argues. If such a thing exists, it's a very interesting concept, first and foremost, but if such a thing exists, again, it seems to fall into a category of things that appear to exist outside of the known, at least as it relates to human mind and cognition and function, you know, our bodies and levels of perception that are known through science today. And there are going to be people who will see Dr. Tatum and say, this is crazy, this is nonsense, especially to liken some faculty of the human mind to Wi-Fi. But is it really? Maybe it's just beyond the known. We'll return here on the Graylin Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylin Report, broadcasting to you live from the fourth dimension of time and space. That's right. Not really. But then again, there may be actually some fourth dimensional representation of ourselves somewhere broadcasting, in which we're not even aware of, Matt. Something outside the senses of humans and our ability to discern, which is an interesting concept.
It is. Maybe in that one, I don't get as many pens thrown at me.
Poor guy. Yeah. He's.
I have hope.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, keep hoping. I didn't throw a pen at him. You know, I'm gonna have like, you know, claims of abuse launched against me by the FCC or something like that. And in fact, we were just joking. The pen has never left my hand. I'm still holding it. Look.
Yeah, I know. I see it there.
Here. But if you keep that up, I'm gonna throw it. No, I'm kidding.
Now, slingshot it this time.
Yeah, well, I'm going to toss it straight up and see if Newtonian physics still bring it back down on my desk. There was an article at Gizmodo. I think you found this one also. Always doing his due diligence, Matthew Oakley, finding great things for us to talk about on this program. And this headline deals with two new experiments that may show an effect similar to the fourth spatial dimension. Marty, you're not thinking fourth dimensionally, okay? There are three spatial dimensions, of course, which we recognize, directions you can move by holding everything else constant. Now, this according to the Gizmodo article, by the way, but some might argue that of the three dimensions that we can recognize as humans, time is essentially the fourth dimension. Now, in this article they write, moving back and forth along a line is moving in one dimension. Making a right angle to that line, you add a second dimension to move forward and backward in, like in a square. But if you make another right angle and you enter the third spatial dimension, you can move up and down, and you've formed a cube. Now, if a fourth dimension existed, you could make another right angle into that and create some sort of a hypercube. A fourth spatial dimension can be described by mathematics, but not physically realized. Do you remember Carl Sagan talking about that? He says the term for this would be a tesseract.
Yes.
Yeah. And he is essentially imagining a fourth dimensional cube.
I done heard it on Marvel stuff too, right?
Yeah. Well, a tesseract, again, you know, is this hypothetical fourth dimensional cube. And that's what, you know, Sagan was talking about. But the Gizmodo article reads, think about it like this. A three-dimensional figure leaves a two-dimensional shadow. By observing that shadow, we can glean some information about the three-dimensional thing, even though what we're observing is essentially in two dimensions. Perhaps by observing some real-world physical system, we can thereby learn about a fourth-dimensional nature by a shadow left in lower dimensions. So that brings us to these two experiments, and each of the new experiments deal with what's called the quantum Hall effect, where electrons are confined to two dimensions as if they are stuck on the surface of a sheet of paper, like in graphene or in certain layers of semiconductors, and a magnetic field is passed through that sheet perpendicularly. Some of the system's electrical properties become restricted to multiples of exact number values. Now, math says that other consequences of this quantum Hall effect should be measurable in a four spatial dimensional system. But again, we don't have four spatial dimensions to test this physics in. This is just a hypothetical. So two teams with their experiments managed to overcome
the problem of this conceptual framework and our inability to work in it. And here's how they did it. They utilized specially engineered systems published today in the journal Nature. For one, a team of European physicists trapped atoms of the element rubidium with sets of lasers in two dimensions. The experiment setup was kind of like an egg crate with atoms in it whose boundaries are governed by lasers. Now, this created a sort of two-dimensional quantum charge pump, as they called it, that allowed them to simulate the transport of electric charges. Atoms aren't charged, of course. An extra parameter, however, based on the internal behavior of these atoms, was coded along each dimension, playing the role of two more spatial dimensions. They were able to use this system to measure the quote-unquote second Chern number, which signifies the presence of the fourth dimensional effects. Now, the other team used light passing through a series of waveguides, or specifically specially fabricated glass that can control the shape of the light wave. It kind of looks like an array of fiber optic cables lined up in a rectangular prism. And like a light bright when observed head-on. Boy, that's a real throwback. Now, these cables are coupled. Light can travel between the tips. By wiggling the spaghetti noodles in the background of these cables, they could simulate the effect of an electric field on a charged particle, as observed in that hypothetical light bright. The researchers watched the light jump to opposite edges and corners of their apparatus, and this would be a physical effect associated with the 4D quantum Hall effect. Okay, now follow me here. The two experiences fill in the pieces, they believe, of understanding of this fourth dimensional effect, even though a fourth dimension cannot be observed. And this according to Michael Loss of the Ludwig Maximilians University in Germany, who told Gizmodo, "I think that the two experiments nicely complement each other. In the simplest sense, the first team of scientists is looking at the 4D effect in the bulk of a physical system, while the second team is looking at the effects on the edges of the same system." Now, if you don't follow all that, or if you do, don't worry, because the point is, scientists are replicating systems which allow them to make observations which we predict essentially are how things, or similar to how things, would function in a fourth dimensional system, which we cannot actually operate in or even easily conceive of. But that doesn't mean that it's not there. We can recognize three dimensions. Hypothetically, there are fourth dimension, fifth dimension, sixth dimensions. And again, really, this is the whole idea of M-brain theory and the concept of a multiverse, that there are perhaps untold numbers of alternate dimensions, and that we can observe and we can operate, and that human cognition allows for perception in at least three of those. But yes, indeed, maybe there are some things that exist outside of what humans can conceive of and the general framework in which our brains typically operate. And if that is indeed the case, the question we have to ask ourselves is, hey, you know, how much do we really know about what we see? How much of what we know, again, is based on, I think a better way to phrase this, actually, if I'm to back up here for a moment, so we're heading out to break. We do know what we can observe, but how many things do we not know based on what we have yet to observe? And we will never know until we study those things and try to observe them. We'll wrap things up here when we return on the Grayland Report. From the high mountains of Appalachia, it is the Grayland Report. Welcome back. Wrapping up this week's segment, or this week's entire program for that matter. You know, there have been a lot of things that have been in the news lately. And these include, of course, some discussion of spontaneous human combustion. Now, there was an incident that occurred back before the holidays. John Noland, who's 70 years old, was reported by the Telegraph, died from horrific burns after being found ablaze near his home in North London back in September. Detectives have now said that after weeks of investigation, they found no obvious cause for the fire that claimed his life. And Matt, you just brought it to my attention today. Apparently, Newsweek reports that there has been another second man, mysteriously, who burst into flames in England. Police are stumped by this. We don't know exactly what caused it, but it does seem awfully similar to this presumed phenomena said to occur from time to time that involves spontaneous human combustion. Daniel Lingwood, a resident of Hull, looked out his window to see flames across the road, according to a local newspaper. He immediately rushed outside to help the victim, who's not yet been named. There were some women going around to get buckets of water to chuck over him. But I've done first aid before, and I knew that would be bad for his skin, so me and another bloke tried to roll him on the ground to put out the fire instead. Now, Detective Superintendent Dave Wood, a local policeman, Newsweek reports, said that emergency services were called just after 8 p.m. following reports of a man on fire. Police are currently appealing for witnesses. The circumstances around why the man was set alight remains unknown, but Wood has said that police are not currently looking for anyone in connection with the incident. I guess that's the question. Why are Londoners suddenly catching a blaze? Is this indeed spontaneous human combustion? Now, there is some precedent for that, and hence the term. It's long been believed by many to just be silliness. Matt, I think you added a Live Science article about this, which offers some facts on the concept. Some of these popular claims about spontaneous human combustion and people who have purportedly spontaneously erupted into flames are wrong. Live Science reports that, for example, there are many photographs of supposed SHC victims that clearly show extensive burning and damage to the clothing and surroundings of the burned person. It's also important to understand a bit of fire forensics. Many fires are self-limiting. That is, they put themselves out naturally before they run out of fuel. One of the most fascinating studies that I saw that dealt with something like this was where they actually took a full dead pig. They put it in a chair in a makeshift living room, and they set the pig on fire. The fat, of course, burned for hours and hours and hours, but this fire didn't spread. Now,
and we have to remember that pig skin is one of the closest things to human skin. So that would be why that happened. But
pig's entire internal organ structure and whatnot. This is part of the reason why often pigs are used for dissections and science classes and things, but. What's interesting, though, is, and this is, I think, the question that is missed by that, we can explain that, that fire may not spread, and therefore there's no paranormal, aspect to this, a person mysteriously catching fire and nothing in their house burning except for them. That may not be all that, unexplainable. What is odd is the source of the ignition. What could possibly cause people to suddenly burst into flames? Now, a century ago, it was blamed on intemperance and even God's wrath. Most victims were assumed to be drunkards who had saturated their cells with alcohol. Although, I should say, there are a lot of reports of this so-called spontaneous human combustion that do involve alcoholics being the ones who tend to be, the victims. And maybe that old folk belief about drunkards being punished for doing so, maybe there's something to that. That's all I'm saying. Now, they go on to say at Live Science, in the 1970s, a quasi-Freudian explanation came into vogue, suggesting a person's depressive emotional states could somehow cause him or her to become inflamed. Others have suggested that sunspots, cosmic storms, gas-producing intestinal bacteria, or even a buildup of the body's supposed vibrational energy may be to blame. And yet they say all these explanations are really pseudoscientific. There's no evidence for any of them. Our bodies are about 60% to 70% non-flammable water, and the simple fact is there's no physical or medical mechanism by which a person could possibly self-combust. If people truly could suddenly burst into flames without being anywhere near an open flame, presumably there would be examples that have occurred while the victim was swimming or in a bathtub or even scuba diving, yet those cases don't exist. I don't know, is that really all that necessarily true? Keep in mind, by the way, that Benjamin Radford is the author of this article, and of course he's a known skeptic. I'm just pointing that out.
Yeah.
Not to say he's wrong. But he concludes and says, though there's no scientific evidence that spontaneous human combustion exists, now and then a case makes the news when officials can't find another explanation. He cites a case from 2011, but we've had two of them in London recently, which seem to at very least indicate a spontaneous human combustion, one of which occurred on a street in broad daylight, and they can't find any reason why this person caught on fire. Now, listen, again, the point is, what if there is some sort of a natural biological reason that this occurs? And what if there are connections between the types of people who are more likely to suffer the SHC? I don't think we should rule it out as a possible phenomenon, because there's plenty of, again, information that supports people catching fire in their homes and sometimes in other places, public places. There have been SHC instances where someone has caught fire right in, you know, full view of a friend sitting on the couch across from them. I don't know. Maybe it can be explained, but maybe we need to at least keep an open mind as to what the cause, you know, self-combusting ignition or otherwise, may be here. That's going to have to be the final word for this week's edition of the program. On behalf of Mr. Oakley and I bid you adieu. And on behalf of all of us here at Grayling International Headquarters, including Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Racing Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrill, Tiffany Mack, and Assistant Lauren, we will catch you guys next time. And as always, stay strange. It's a weird world out there.
You've been listening to the Grayling Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Grayling Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, graylingreport.com.